camp, there's about eight of us that went down there.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order, and it's Wednesday, May 26, 2010, and we will be having an informational meeting today on a wide range of topics today, and I appreciate some of the input that I've received on these, and I hope to be able to move through this agenda and be done before 4 o'clock. So with that, but I want to make sure we also have time to ask questions throughout the process today as well on these individual topics. So with that, I'll open the informational meeting, and I would like to start out with our government waste reporting hotline and hearing a report from that. And I believe we have someone from the audits division, from the Secretary of State, being the director, Gary Blackmire. And welcome to our committee again. And if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. My name is Gary Blackmire. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. And I can give you a quick little briefing on our hotline and open it up to questions at your pleasure, Chair.
Yes, I'd like you to start out with sort of a description of the program, because I think there's a lot of folks out there that don't know what it is or that it even existed, and you know, what kind of work it has entailed, and perhaps what kind of feedback you've gotten on this, and what happens with that feedback once you get it.
Sure. Under Oregon Revised Statutes 177.180, our office is the point where members of the public, state employees, can contact us confidentially or anonymously to let us know of concerns that they have about government waste or inefficiencies or allegations of fraud, any concerns that they have. They can contact us by telephone. The number is 1-800-336-8218, or they can come to the Secretary of State's Audits Division website, and there's a link there, or they can go directly to http://fraud.oregon.gov, and that will take them to a website where they can put the information in. What we do is we obtain that information. We contract with the national firm to provide the telephone call taking, and we take that information and put it into a database and track each of those calls that come in and do a preliminary investigation to decide what the next step is. Based upon what we come up with that preliminary investigation, we may find that it has nothing to do with state government. It may be a federal issue, and we have means of posting to our website or asking callers to leave to call back for more information, where we can convey to them the status of their complaint. So we may say, this is actually Department of Interior of the U.S. government. We would urge you to contact that agency. So at this point, the state law doesn't allow us to direct that directly over to the Department of the Interior, for example. So it would encourage the caller to contact a federal agency in that case. Once we have gone through the process of screening, we may find that it requires further investigation, and we will assign an auditor to it, and they will conduct an investigation to determine specifically what facts and evidence we can gather around that allegation. There are occasions when we find that what may appear to be, inefficiency or misuse, in fact, isn't, and we will close the case at that point, let the caller know that, in fact, the evidence doesn't support that for these reasons, or these perceptions may be valid, but, in fact, this is a case where the money is appropriately being allocated to a certain activity. So those are a certain number of cases, and there are others where we actually actually do find wrongdoing or inefficiencies, and we issue a report in those cases. So those are all publicly issued. They're on our website. So we've had a number of those reports over the years. And at this point, we've identified approximately $8.1 million in either question costs or inefficiencies that have come from these hotline calls. So we certainly do rely upon the public to help give us those insights. In 2009, we had 347 calls that we investigated, and of those, we resolved a number of them immediately. We have a number of them that we're still working on. There are 11 that remain open of those 347 that we're still kind of gathering information on or further research being conducted. And we've issued a number of reports in 2009 on those. We've put out extra requests for information on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, the stimulus funds, asking people specifically if they have concerns about how those funds are being used, that they contact the hotline. And about 2% of our calls in 2009 had allegations around those funds, and we looked at those as well. Just to give you some idea, in terms of some of the investigations we've done this year, we looked at the Oregon Military Department and how they were renting their armory and found some areas where they could be more consistent and in terms of charging for rental. We also looked at the Oregon Commission for Blind in terms of some of the spending that went on there and questioned some of their business purposes for the spending. And we also looked at the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and Baker Valley Soil and Water Conservation District and saw some areas there where they could better manage their contracts in terms of the public contracting process and making sure that it was all done in a clear and accountable manner. So those were some of the key letters that we issued this year. So that's kind of a quick overview. We've been operating the office since 1995, and like I say, we will accept email, letters, telephone calls, any means of contacting us, and we can maintain the confidentiality of the person providing that information. And state statutes allow us to do that. So we issue reports when there are allegations that are substantiated. When those are not substantiated, we don't issue them, and we don't even say what the allegations were. That's the way the law is currently stated.
So I understand that you don't get into the federal use of dollars as much as you do with the state, but you did reference some sub-jurisdictions, local jurisdictions. So you also take reports and on local government and local entities?
Yes, we do. And actually, if the state is given federal dollars to carry out its responsibilities, we will investigate those as well. But if it were, say, the U.S. Department of Interior that the hotline call came in on, we would simply not be investigating that one. That would be a federal matter. Mm-hmm. So, but if, for example, Interior gave dollars to our forestry department, in that case, we would be investigating state forestry to see if there were an issue there that needed further investigation.
So is it, I know you got 347 calls in 2009, so do you actually have an investigator look into all 347 of those issues that are reported?
Yes, we do. Yes, we have meetings every 2 weeks to talk through the new calls that have come in to kind of define what would be the steps we would want to conduct in a preliminary investigation for each of those calls. And then ultimately, when that preliminary investigation is done, we would determine, you know, what disposition we would take, whether we would do more investigation, whether we would close the call off, whether there are other issues that came to light that we would want to expand our investigation. So those are ongoing meetings we have with our staff.
And beyond doing a report of your findings on these particular issues, do you report to anyone else? I mean, the Secretary of State, obviously, but does the Secretary of State's office report back to the governor's office or the legislature or what they're finding? I mean, I found this kind of interesting because I hadn't really heard much about what has been accomplished with this hotline. And so I'm just sort of intrigued. The statute doesn't require you to report back to us, obviously, but I'm just sort of interesting. Do you put out a report that's, you say you have individual reports on the mm-hmm. on the website for individual things you look at, but I'm just thinking of an overall program report.
Yes, actually the state law requires us to issue an annual report, which we put on our website, and we're only a matter of probably a week or two away from releasing it. We were just finishing up the report when you asked us to come brief you. So my numbers are very up to date, and they will soon be published in our report and on our website.
So could I ask you to send our committee administrator that annual report, and I could probably find it on the website if I looked really hard.
We'd be happy
to. But I'd like to disseminate it to the committee if possible.
We'd be happy to do that.
Other questions, Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said there were 400 and some that you decided to investigate. What's the total number of calls you get in a year?
This last year we had 347 calls or contacts, whether they were an email or something like that, that came in. And we do do a preliminary review of each of those to determine what our next steps would be. So each of those does get a preliminary review. Yes.
Thank you. Other questions of Mr. Blackmer? I guess I got all the questions out, so I appreciate you reporting on that, and perhaps you don't have to get up, because I think you're in our next little panel as well.
We'll slide over.
So I appreciate that. I'd like Stephanie Smythe as well. Next, we're going to be talking about the use of construction management general contractor provisions in public contracting in construction. And there's been a little bit of interest in this in this building this week. And I thought it appropriate to perhaps get a overview of how this fits into our public contracting statutes, and as we know, the Attorney General does the model public contracting rules, and how this applies to public contracting, and try to give us a somewhat of an overview of the use of CMGCs and its purpose, and just some information about it. So thank you. Could you introduce yourself to the record, please?
Thank you, Representative Holvey and members of the committee. I am Stephanie Smythe. I'm the attorney in charge of the business transactions section at Department of Justice. And with me is Blake Underwood, who is the practice chair of the design and construction practice group within that section. I am going to speak very generally and then turn it over to Mr. Underwood, who has much more detailed day-to-day experience with CMGC contracting. The main thing that is different about construction manager general contractor contracting from the conventional low bid construction contracting that many of you are probably already familiar with is that it's a collaborative process where the construction manager general contractor is actually brought in quite early in the design phase and works with the owner of the project, in our case that would be the state agency, and the designer or architect to develop the plans and specifications, to work on concepts such as value engineering that would save money in the course of the project, and to determine whether the project as designed is actually constructible. So these are advantages both in terms of timing and in terms of cost to agencies when it's properly administered. And in the design bid build standard type of contracting, which we call low bid contracting, The construction contractor comes in much later in the process after the architect has already worked with consultants and engineers to develop the plans and specifications for the project. And at that point, there is an invitation to bid. The agency puts that out and invites the construction contracting community to submit bids. And the lowest responsive bid for those plans and specifications is to be selected. So in that process, it's more of a linear process, less of the collaborative team approach to the design and the construction of the project. There's also a different dynamic as between the architect and the construction contractor, because in the design, bid, build type of construction project, the architect oversees the work of the contractor after having designed it. And in the construction manager general contractor method, there is more participation by both parties in the design. So different dynamic, and sometimes that can result in a project that's better designed to suit the purposes of the owner. And then as far as the process that's actually followed, I'm going to turn that over to Mr. Underwood to talk about the competitive procurement aspect of construction manager, general contractor, some examples of projects that have used this method, and also some of the complexities that arise in the course of using it. At the end of our handout on pages 3 to 5, there are some references that the committee can use to look at later on a guide for the CMGC process, some definitions that come out of our rules and the Bureau of Labor and Industries rules and the DAS rules. Because the statutes actually speak very little to construction manager, general contractor. They simply allow a method to be used that is different from the standard competitive bidding process. Most of the actual regulations are fleshed out by rule. So, Mr. Underwood?
Could I ask a question before we move on, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So I'm a little bit confused. Are we talking about state-funded projects?
Yes.
Okay. Where does it say that? Public contracting. Okay, got it. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't pick up on that.
But now I'm a little bit confused, because there probably are projects that aren't state-funded that fall under these rules as well. A city, for example, could use a CMGC process without state funding. I don't know if that happens, but it's possible.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, certainly local governments could use construction manager general contractor methods as well. So I'm speaking to our experience with state projects, but local governments can use it as well. And in the private sector, it is also used, but not subject to these rules.
So it's publicly funded projects, correct? Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, or the use of this under public, with public contracts.
Okay,
that's the framework for this.
Got it. Thank you.
But it does involve local governments as well as state government as well. They have to follow these rules that are promulgated by the Attorney General's office, I believe.
Yes, that's right, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. The rules apply to state agencies and local governments if they are not exempted from the rules. And in the case of local governments, I'm not aware of any exemptions that apply to them. There are some specific ones that apply to state agencies in the public contracting code.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, school districts?
Yes, that's true. They're local governments included.
So they're not exempt. They are coming under this, too.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Blake Underwood, also with the Department of Justice in the Business Transactions section of General Counsel. I'm going to continue the discussion as to the competitive process that is normally used for construction manager, general contractor contracts. There is... I guess the first thing to talk about is it's an alternative contracting method, as Ms. Smythe just described. The statutes require a special process before a CMGC contract can be used for agencies that are subject to the public contracting laws. So this is a non-competitive, it's not a competitive bidding situation. an agency such as the Department of Corrections, for example, would have to go to the Department of Administrative Services and obtain an exemption from the competitive bidding process in order to conduct a CMGC procurement. The CMGC procurement is a very competitive process that is typically used by public entities. The process needs to be exempted because the agency will not be considering just low price. They will be evaluating the qualifications of the firms to determine which firm is best suited for the particular project. They will also be considering price, but they will not be able to consider price in the usual method because the design documents would not have been completed to the level that the project could be fully understood and fully bid and priced by the firms. So what happens is the price component in a CMGC procurement is limited to the costs for what are called their pre-construction services. The first phase of work, a CMGC contract is a multi-phase contract. The first phase of work does not involve construction. It involves pre-construction services that Ms. Smythe described as being, you know, interacting with the architect, interacting with the owner, doing constructability reviews, etc. That first phase of work is not construction work, and that would typically be part of the procurement process. The agency would request, what are you firms, please provide us with your bid for the pre-construction services that will be provided. They will also provide price-related data having to do with the profit or fee that the firm will charge for will be charged against the cost of the project. So those dollars associated with pre-construction services and their fee will be part of the evaluation process. Let me talk for a moment a bit about the exemption process.
Before you go on, just a quick question about that CMGC procurement process.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That you're just describing, because you had mentioned that it is the procurement of the CMGC is bid competitively, or there's some sort of requirement to get proposals from different places or different entities to do the CMGC, or can I guess what I'm trying to get at is that process also requires some sort of request for proposal that's evaluated against other requests, so there isn't just one request or proposal coming in.
That's generally correct. The exemption process that I'll describe here in a moment really is the context for what the procurement will look like. If the exemption process is designed to take the transaction outside of the normal low bid competitive process, and typically the agency will describe the competitive process that they intend to use, if there is to be one. There are circumstances under which the exemption process could result in a contract going to a particular firm so that there would not be a competitive process, but that is not the norm. The norm is that the agency would in the case of DOC, for example, proceed to Department of Administrative Services, describe the competitive process that they intend to use, describe the form of contract that they intend to use, and present findings as to how the project will meet the statutory requirements in terms of competitive, you know, process, avoiding special treatment for consultant for contractor firms, etc. So that exemption process really is the first step of a CMGC contract, and from that exemption process, then they would go to a request for proposals, where they would typically receive a number of proposals from a number of firms, evaluate the written proposals that they would receive, which are very comprehensive, given the fact that most of these projects are very large and complex. And then they would typically want to do an interview of the key personnel from the firms that will actually be doing the work. If the contract is awarded to the firm, the idea is bring your people that we're actually going to be working with. Let us talk to them. Let us see them in action to see if your team will be an effective team for us. And then after that initial process, the CMGC contract would be signed with the highest rated proposer. That initial contract, as I mentioned earlier, is not a contract to construct the project at that point. It is a contract to perform certain technical pre-construction services in cooperation with the owner and in cooperation with the architect. And that phase of the work proceeds for a number of months until the design documents are to the point where the project is taking shape and the contractor is able to price the guaranteed maximum price for the entire project. At that point in the contractual relationship between the public entity and the CMGC firm, the design documents, which don't have to be 100% complete, but they need to be very, very far down the road, they are presented to the CMGC. The CMGC then does a competitive process for the major components of the work through a subcontractor solicitation process. These are not public contracts. This subcontractor procurement process that the CMGC firm conducts is regulated by the contract, typically, but it is not a public contract, and those contracts are not part, do not have to comply with the requirements of the public contracting code, but they do have to meet typically very competitive requirements that are set forth in the CMGC contract that informs the firm you have to engage in this competitive process so that there is competition at the subcontractor level. Once those bids have been determined, the CMGC then presents a proposal to the owner, which describes the work, describes the firms that will, the subcontractor firms or the CMGC firm itself that will do the work, and a guaranteed maximum price for the project, so that the agency has the ability to know what this thing is going to cost. And then the CMGC contract is amended with what's called a guaranteed maximum price amendment. That is a fairly comprehensive amendment and now sets the price for the project. And that can be some months from the time that the original contract was signed. It is also important probably for you to know that it's more common now in CMGC practice for the guaranteed maximum price to be a little bit later in the process. The CMGC method allows for what's called early work. It's an efficiency sort of idea that, well, the design documents are not fully complete, but they're to the point that they're complete as to one phase of the work. And so we can get the process started. We might, time is money, as we all know, and the agency will be hoping to meet or beat the schedule for construction. And the more that early work can be done, early construction work to be done, the better. And so we're seeing a pattern now. Many agencies are doing what are called early work amendments, which are small phases of construction work, which are then performed, and there's a guaranteed price for that early work. There may be one early work amendment, or there may be a series of them, and then after the early work amendments are completed, then the guaranteed maximum price amendment takes place, so the agency has certainty as to the full cost of the project. I should probably stop there at that moment to see if there's any questions about that. I know that's a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's tough to follow for me, and I'm familiar a little bit with it. I did have one. You made a comment earlier that I guess I have to question, where you, I think you said that, and I'm not sure at what stage this is at, that subcontracts were not subject to the public contracting code?
Correct.
And so that's the subcontract between the CMGC and the individual subcontractors that they're hiring to do the actual work?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And but it seems to me that I also know that those subcontractors are subject to part of 279C, which is the prevailing wage requirements under the public contracting code. So they're not exempt from that part of the code. I don't think, are they?
Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. The provisions, there are certain parts of 279C in sections 800 to 870 that are known as the prevailing wage rate statutes. There are BOLI administrative rules that implement those statutes, and the subcontractors do have to comply with those laws to the extent that they do apply to them. That typically has to do with certified payroll records, which are provided to the CMGC, and which the CMGC then is required to provide to the public agency.
So I'm just trying to follow the logic behind the subcontracts not being subject to the public contracting code. I guess that's because they have a contract with the CMGC that's subject to the code, so everything flows downhill, and they still have to do competitive bidding on those subcontracts, according to the code?
They do not have to do competitive bidding. The code applies to not all public entities, but most public entities, and so the contracts of those public entities with an outside firm have to comply with the requirements of the code in terms of procurement, competitive bidding, or other bidding processes that might be required under the public contracting code. However, when we get to that next level, where the CMGC firm, who's a private firm, is now subcontracting part of the work that the CMGC will be legally obligated to perform, those contracts are between private entities. And so in terms of the competitive process, they're not required to comply with the code since they're not public contracts.
Interesting. So if they're not subject to those subcontracts are not subject to the public contracting code in terms of competitive bidding, they have to meet some other requirement or not, because they're between private parties. You're saying that they don't have to comply to anything? I mean, it seems like there'd be some other kind of alternative process that's required in that. Or is it just the guarantee of the CMGC that... Well, I'd like to answer that.
Yeah, I was going to
answer that. Okay, Mr. Chairman, would you like to respond?
I believe the two things that do apply to the subcontracts, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, are whatever requirements are in the contract between the public entity and the CMGC. And Mr. Underwood was saying that those contracts many times do contain specific requirements for some form of competitive selection process for subs, but that's not required by the statute. And the other thing that does apply to the subcontractors is the prevailing wage portion of the public contracting code, but not the solicitation methodology part.
Okay, so it does flow down, though, from the original contract.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Riley.
Thank you. So whatever is written into the contract for the CMGC is what is required of the CMGC to require the subcontractors to do. But that contract could be whatever the agency wants it to be, basically.
In terms of solicitation requirements, I mm-hmm. believe that's true. Do you have any other information?
Vice Chair Riley, that's correct. There, as to subcontracting procurement processes, that's correct. The agency typically will want to have some hand as to how these subcontracts are obtained. If there was no requirement of a competitive process by the agency in the contract, then they typically these firms have subcontractor firms they regularly use, and there would not be a competitive process, and as a result there might be inflation of subcontracted work. One other concept that I would want to make sure that the chair and the committee is aware of is the contract itself has very complex requirements that are imposed on the CMGC firm. The CMGC firm will then be handing off a component of the work to that subcontractor firm. The firms are not doing this sort of work because they're not sophisticated, and they know that they have to impose many of the same legal requirements that they are obligated to perform to the agency. They have to require that downstream, otherwise they will not get the product that complies with the contract terms. So they very typically impose many of those provisions downstream.
Yeah, that's the part I was trying to get to, I guess.
Any other questions? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have four short questions. Mr. Underwood, in the testimony we have or the written information, it says that it's typically, this CMGC is typically used in private construction projects. So my first question is, how about, it says public construction, how about private construction projects? Second, who selects the architect and when in the process does that happen? And finally, does this process, it appears that it requires more government oversight to actually use in a construction project. Could you comment on that, please?
Representative Wisnett, I'd be glad to, Mr. Chairman. The method is used in private business as well. Typically, the procurement competitive process there is much less comprehensive, but it is a widespread method that's used in both private and public projects. As to the selection of the architect, the public agency that procures, you know, enters into an agreement with the CMGC contractor also has a separate earlier procurement process to procure architect engineer services, and it's the public entity, the public agency retains that architect to represent the interests of the agency in the process and to oversee, to some extent, the work of the CMGC. So in a CMGC procurement, the agency still has their advocate, still has their technical expert on the construction process that is obligated to the agency. And so they're getting independent advice from that architect and help in handling the project with this very sophisticated CMGC firm that's now on board. As far as government oversight, there is a significant amount of government oversight, both in the initial process of the exemption being granted. There's also when the exemption is to be obtained, there's a public hearing requirement. That the agency hold a public hearing and receive comment from the public or from the contracting community as to whether it's a good idea for there to be an exemption for this particular project as sought by the agency. The public hearing is held, comments are received, a record is kept of those hearings, and the comments are taken into consideration by the agency as they proceed, taken into consideration by DAS in terms of whether they should grant the exemption in the first place, and then if there's a comment about the way the project might be done more effectively, those comments are taken into consideration by the agency before they do the procurement. There's also, under 279C355, a post-project evaluation requirement for contracts that are exempted under the Public Contracting Code. The agency would have to submit a report to the Department of Administrative Services as to the effectiveness of the project and the cost savings that were expected. Were those really achieved? There's a number of elements in the statute that are to be included in that post-project evaluation report so that there's a public oversight of that in terms of, okay, we thought from the front side this was a good idea. Now the project is complete. We have a report about how things went and whether this is really a good thing for the government to continue doing going forward.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Underwood, for that information. It appears to me, as someone not a builder or contractor, that it's really important selecting the architect. Dr. Goldberg is very qualified to do what he does, but I'm not sure he's qualified to pick this person that's going to be the real leader of this project. Does DOJ have, do you advise him, or does DAS have someone that helps him? How does Dr. Goldberg get to make that, how does he get help in making that decision, who he's going to hire as his architect?
In Dr. Goldberg's case, representative, or in other agencies' situations, they do have resources available to them in the Department of Administrative Services, but they obtain quite a bit of that from the Department of Justice. We and the Business Transactions Section have a significant experience with CMGC contracting, and we advise, we oversee the process to some extent. The A&E contract solicitation documents would typically, for a project of this size, come to our office for review. We approve the architecture contracts that that would support this project. And then we're also involved in the review of the procurement documents, the exemption process,
that's
and then the resulting contracts.
That answered. Thank you.
Mr. Raleigh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that $5,000 is the floor for CMGC contracts. That seems an awfully low project for exemptions to use something like CMGC. Is that...
Vice Chair Riley, I should supplement the materials so that it's a little clearer that the exemption process is has two components to it. There are certain kinds of contracts that can be done in a non-competitive fashion without going through the exemption process. And those, the $5,000 contract that you mentioned, as well as a number of other the agreements that are mentioned there in terms of repair, energy savings performance contracts, there are certain types of contracts that don't have to go through this exemption process. They can just go do a non-competitive procurement without going through the process. Then the other projects that aren't in that limited group then have to go through the full exemption process, where the agency would present findings as to why it is a good idea to do the project. And then those are individual kind of agency-by-agency projects that have to go through the process as opposed to a type of contract at the top.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So what's a typical project look like that would go through this exemption process? And, you know, there must be some guidelines as to when you would even start to go through this process.
CMGC contracting is not well suited to certain kinds of projects, where projects are smaller, less technical, where there's less complexities with completing the project itself. It is not a good candidate for CMGC. CMGC projects are typically very large, complex projects. Department of Corrections on their prison construction projects. It's a standard method that DOC would use because of the immense scale and complexity of the building. The hospital projects, such as the DHS hospital project, again, a very large, complex project that would require a firm with very significant expertise and capacity to do a project of that size. Sports stadiums such as the remodel of the Autzen Stadium, another good candidate for this sort of project. The city of Portland did their Expo Center project was done using CMGC. Residence halls for the university system are also a common type of project that's done through CMGC. Something they're typically not done for less than $10 million. Although there have been a few, they're normally much more complex projects in excess of $10 million.
I think Representative Riley brings up a good point, just in that exact description. But what I'm hearing from you is there's really no definitive, you know, price range for CMGC or something. But I typically see most public agencies now using CMGCs to build just about everything they do. And I'm from school building to a fire station to a library or any of these public buildings, and I'm trying to understand why all of these buildings are you know, and certainly maybe they're $15, $20, $30 million maybe,
but they still are basically an essential building, and I'm kind of curious why those qualify as complex, you know, structures that would get the approval of DAS for a CMGC process, as opposed to having an architect design a building and a general contractor building it. I'm trying to understand, what really makes that decision happen.
It's hard to speculate what's in the minds of some folks who might use the method. I think, if I could hazard a guess, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the one of the key components of a CMGC contract is evaluation of qualifications, being able to evaluate how good a particular firm is, how financially stable they are. Are they stretched too thin with their various projects out there, and they're not really capable of doing your project? You wouldn't really know that in a competitive bidding situation. So I think some folks are drawn to it as, well, this is a way for us to evaluate qualifications. Well, there's other ways for you to do that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do a CMGC contract to be able to evaluate qualifications. You will still have to have an exemption process in most cases if you're subject to the code. But you can ask for a non-competitive process and just add in a qualifications component. The other possibility is that for particular agencies, while that fire station might to us not seem like as comprehensive as a $200 million hospital, for that agency, that might be a integral cog in their operation, which may affect their effectiveness as an agency to do their job. So schedule, maybe finishing the project early, hoping to have a more collaborative environment, having fewer conflicts between the design phase of the work and the construction phase might be a motivation to save money, save time, which of course saves money. So that could be a factor, that they just don't have time to have a 3 or 4 year construction process. They want to condense that down, allow overlap for the design phase and the construction phase to overlap, create efficiencies, and be done with their project much sooner. Now, that could be one of their motivations.
Mm. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I forgot you were down there.
I think the I certainly have heard from a contractor or two within my own district that there's perception that this system is used to preference certain people who may have size or dominance in the state. And what I want to know is your reaction to that charge. And secondly, whose job is it to hold public entities accountable who make this choice if they made this choice and it was actually a more costly choice than if they had used the bid system?
As to preferences being given, that would not, if the process for an exemption from competitive bidding is followed according to what the law requires, the agency would not be able to justify their choice of this process if they were doing it using a preference. The justification would be suspect in that case. So is there a method to oversee that? First off, when the Department of Justice is involved in assisting with the exemption from the competitive bidding process, we're very careful to make sure that the justification offered by the agency is accurate, supportable, and if there were a challenge, that we could defend that decision. It doesn't guarantee that if we are not aware of what's happening in the background, that there could not be a preference, but if the facts came out that there had been a preference afforded to a particular contractor once the selection process was engaged in, then there would be the potential for the competitors to bring a lawsuit, and in that case, the government would have to defend their their selection process. It is meant to be competitive. Once the exemption is granted, there is some form of a competitive procurement that's ensconced within that exemption, unless the agency has actually demonstrated that there is only one source of a contractor to perform the specific work. All of that has to be justified. All of it's challengeable in court. And then as far as oversight, if there isn't a legal challenge, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, then there would be a possibility of an audit by the Secretary of State, and that would be another way to uncover whether there was any favoritism in the award.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the slow learners here, there are a number of state agencies we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. I assume you're all involved because of the contractual nature of this. Who's got the ultimate authority? I was trying to find it in the statute for these matters. Is it General Services? What do we call it?
BASS.
Is it you all? How does that pecking order work? I'm just curious.
Representative Gilliam and members of the committee, the Department of Administrative Services is the one for all agencies except for the Department of Transportation, who decides whether the exemption is to be awarded. In the case of local governments, it's their local contracting review board. And what we do is we are the legal advisor to the agency, and we assist them in drafting the documents to support the exemption.
Okay, that helps. Thanks.
See, I haven't put anybody to sleep yet. I know this is a little bit dry, but this is a very important issue, and I'm still, I guess, a little bit troubled that we really don't have a really clear definition of when these are appropriate to use and when they're not. But I guess I can understand, you know, you're looking at a lot of different things, timing and, you know, the value of the project at its end. And certainly the exemptions still have to, you know, comply to the use of public funds and producing a benefit back to the public and a value that I guess the contracting agency is deciding what is the best proposal to them, whether it's, you know, the cheapest or whether it's the one that provides the end product that they desire. Mm-hmm. You have a thought you want to throw in there?
I wanted to ask one more question if I could.
Certainly. Go ahead.
I wanted to know if you have an answer about how many corporations, companies are qualified to do CMGCs in the state.
Representative Riley, Mr. Chairman, a very good question. I'm probably not the best person to make that assumption. I can tell you that when these procurements are done, there are, depending on the type of project it is, there's a range usually of 5 to 15 or 20 firms that we will see proposing. There may be a large number of other entities out there that are qualified. But that's a range of firms. Sometimes it's less than that. A recent project we did for the ON project, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network project, there were three proposing firms. So it can be a very select group if you have a very difficult or unique project. And if it's something that's a little bit more standardized, like a residence hall, we'll typically see more in the 15 to 20 range.
How many different corporations do you think we have used? You say there are up to 15. You know, obviously, you know, one of the things you're going to look at is how many of these CMGC projects have you done in the last 5 years, or have you done? You know, so what happens? Does that get smaller because of that kind of a qualification?
I would, in terms of the firms that we, the contracts we've been involved with in the firms, I would say there's 8 to 10 firms that have received the various different types of CNVC contracts out there. There's a very wide range of projects, so it's some of them are smaller entities.
So on Owen, was it the General Dynamics, was that the CNVC?
They were selected as the highest ranked proposer there. Yes, sir.
Any other questions of this?
And this may be a question for you guys, or maybe, thank you, Mr. Chair, or even for the Chair. What do we know about sort of Oregon versus non-Oregon in the makeup of these firms, I mean, like General Dynamics versus, you know, what do we know about that already, in addition to what we've already talked about?
You want to hazard a guess? Representative Smith, Mr. Chair, It's very hard to say. General Dynamics is not an Oregon firm.
Yeah, that's not hard to say.
The other two firms that proposed, I believe, were Oregon firms. A number of, just kind of off the top of my head, some of the firms that have received the contracts in the past have been Oregon firms. I would say, I hate to be held to a guess, but I think that there's probably a larger percentage of Oregon firms that have received CNVC contracts for state agencies than outside firms, and it may be significantly more than half.
How, if at all, does that come into the analysis? Is it directly looked at? Do we worry merely, well, it's graft if we give it to them because it's, you know, that we'd worry about under the table payments or, you know, promises of jobs afterwards, or is it to the good because, oh, that'll mean that money will circulate more in the local economy, we'll get more tax revenue? How, if at all, do we sort of wrestle with, you know, sort of geography and selection?
It's a sensitive issue depending on the funding for the project. If there are federal funds for the project, the idea of a local preference would be prohibited. Mm-hmm. There are still ways for the agency to deal with the issues that you're mentioning, Representative Smith, in sense of with the proposals, the firms can be requested to provide a plan for how they will address economic conditions in Oregon and how will they maximize economic growth in Oregon through this project. And the firm that comes up with a proposal to do that more effectively than another firm, that would be a fair evaluation factor, even in the case of federal funding. But the agencies would have more flexibility in terms of a local preference with state-funded projects. However, there is a consequence of that in the statutes that there could be a kind of reverse preference that an opposing state could place on an Oregon firm trying to propose to do work in that other state. Mm-hmm. So it's a strategic sort of question that the agency needs to make. And typically there's not a direct preference that the agency will give to in-state firms. It's more this concept of how will you invigorate the local economy? Mm-hmm. How will you involve local subcontractor firms and who can most effectively accomplish that?
Final?
Go ahead.
I would just say this is something I hope we'll think about and look into. I mean, how do we balance that sort of thing and making sure we're picking and maybe it's analyzing the standards that we use. I know ODOT has moved to what was overall best value contracting rather than just least cost contracting, so it can take into account overall factors, and hopefully that doesn't lead to graft or stupidity. But, I mean, you know, looking at this, do we see how we make good choices? I hope it's something we might consider taking a further look at as a committee. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for those comments. I think it's, you know, appropriate to think about, you know, what is best for Oregon when we're using Oregon dollars. Previously, before I was going down a road of, you know, trying to identify a definition for what is an appropriate project or not, and just looking at the statutes and haven't looked at your rules quite specifically enough. But and it doesn't seem like there's a size or type of project that really has a real line for a threshold as
we were speaking about a dollar, you know, when is it appropriate for a CMGC project? Is it $1,000? Is it $1 million? Is it $10 million? Is it $100 million? And, you know, because our, I guess, definitions of when one can be used are such that they don't really spell that out, or whether it's a building or whether, you know, whatever, because every project can be a different and have different requirements and different potentials for value to the customer. But do you think that there is, and I hate to ask you an opinion on policy, but in regards to whether or not a particular project is appropriate, and our statutes really don't spell out specifically when a project is appropriate, and you know, we've heard a lot of concerns about how the use of these is dealing out a lot of local contractors, for example, or something. Do you think there's a need for better defining when a CMGC project is appropriate and when it isn't?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll speak first, but then I'll ask Blake to add his two cents as well. One of the things that we like about the Public Contracting Code, actually, is that it provides flexibility for governments to not always have to hew to a certain formula in deciding how to award projects, mm-hmm. as long as they meet certain general criteria. And our model public contract rules also reflect that same kind of viewpoint, that, you know, we have to, of course, watch for and make sure that agencies are exercising their judgment appropriately, but we do want to allow agencies who are making good decisions to exercise that judgment and have that flexibility. So we try not to box them in, and that is the general framework for our rules. I think that if we were to take an approach where we specified a dollar value at which CMGC contracts would be appropriate, we would want to involve members of local government as well as state agencies and the industry in deciding that that was an appropriate thing to do. We often are informed of things in the process of developing our rules that give us an insight that we might not have just thinking about it at the top of our heads. So that is something we could look at. We do promulgate new rules every 2 years after every legislative session. So that could be something we'll put on our list and see, does that appear to be an appropriate way to go? Do you have any other additions?
Mr. Chairman, members mm-hmm. of the committee, the flexibility that exists at the statutory level, at least from the lawyer's point of view, has worked. The rule that we have a series of rules, but in our model public contracting manual, but the key rule as to CMGC is OER 137.049.0690, which lays out in some complexity a series of steps that should be kept by agencies in doing the procurement process. When one finishes reading the rule, it's pretty clear that the CMGC process is not for the faint of heart. And folks should not go down that path without sophisticated staff or consultants. There was a reference earlier to the state hospital project. Dr. Goldberg really took very significant steps to find a very sophisticated architect to help him with the project. They also had a project management firm to help with that project, which is just massive in its scale and complexity. There's also a technical consultant that the agency hired to assist with technical issues so that the agency would not be skinned during the process. So I think, and we were at a part in advising the agency in going down those pathways. So from the lawyer's perspective, the process works 99% of the time, and the agencies either have internal staff that are very sophisticated, such as the folks in ODOT, for example, who are venturing down the CMGC route, or they have very sophisticated consultants to make sure that the process goes as well as it can.
Thank you, and I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that you engage, you know, in coming up with a change to that at this point. I'm purely just trying to educate myself and my committee is as much as they want to be educated on this subject matter. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now. And I want to move on to Mr. Blackmer and give him a few moments to speak to the CMGC process. And I think they've laid out a pretty thorough explanation of it. And the Audits Division, the Secretary of State, is an agency where if there was a problem or something was contested, I would assume that it would end up in your division to take a look at it. And how does that happen? Or has it happened?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We hope that generally there are provisions in the contracts on disputes between the contractors
and if you'd reintroduce
agencies.
Yourself for the record,
sorry.
Please.
Gary Blackmer, Director of Audits, the Secretary of State's Office. And I guess from our standpoint, we look at CMGC contracts or construction projects like any other construction project, that there are a lot of key elements in those that they share with all the others that we can audit. But it also starts earlier in terms of the quality of overall management of the project. There was some discussion about that if an agency doesn't have a clear vision of what it needs, it may produce a very efficient, high-quality building that doesn't serve its needs. So we even look a little earlier in terms of how well the agency has articulated specifically what it's looking for in terms of that building. So we can look even before that contractor gets on board to see what, you know, how well the agency has done through the whole process. But once they've engaged, from our standpoint, we're looking at, you know, timeliness, quality, and cost in terms of our audit. So the contractors are still providing invoices for approval, and we can look at those invoices to make sure that the costs that are assigned are appropriate and not, you know, they're loading them with overhead charges that they're charging elsewhere and getting paid twice. We're looking at change orders, especially those things. They are reflections in, to a certain degree, of how well the agency has planned out what it needs, because if it gets down the line and realizes that it hadn't thought something through and it wants a change, that can be very costly. And so the negotiation that goes on around what that change will cost in terms of revisions to either the blueprints or actually something that's on the ground can be very complex, and the charges that are loaded into it can be very difficult to sort out and determine what really was changed and what was actually part of the original bid that was put forward.
I understand the how specific the complexities of conducting an audit on a project would be, but I guess my question is more general into what prompts your division to actually look at a project, and of the public projects in the state, what percentage of them do you think the audits division has, and generally rough, and I won't hold you to an accurate figure because you probably haven't ever looked at that, but how often does this happen? I mean, how often does the Secretary of State look at a public project?
Well, let me kind of run through a list of the more recent ones. We looked at the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project. This was early in the process to see how well they were setting the groundwork for it. The Biomedical Research Building at the Oregon Health Sciences University, the Northwest Center for Engineering, Science, and Technology at Portland State University, the training facility at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, Research Stadium at Oregon State University, and Department of Corrections, that was the Madras Correctional Facility, and these were the CMGC ones. And in fact, our most recent one was the Oregon State Hospital, and I think the title says it all, which was Oregon State Hospital Replacement. Good construction management practices help protect state investment. So we actually found that they were doing a good job of managing the initial part of this construction project. So we looked look at construction as a very large outlay of public dollars, and there's an expectation that that building is going to have to last, unfortunately, probably 80 or 100 years the way financing goes these days, and that it needs to be built for the wear and tear of mm-hmm. public service for a long period of time. So we do put that as a key element of our audit plan when we're considering areas to audit. And if a request comes in, we will try to accommodate that with the resources we have.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I just, in your description, I got another question for you before I move on. In your description, most of those are all state projects. What would trigger a local entity project, like a school district or a city building or something for the Secretary of State's office to, or your division to go, oh, maybe we should look at this?
Well, Mr. Chair, that is more complex because of the funding mechanism. Local governments don't provide any reimbursement to us for audits that we initiate. We would have to negotiate some kind of an agreement with that entity. If the Department of Education, for example, asked us to go in to look at a local school district, we could do that under the auspices mm-hmm. of the assessment process we have with Oregon.
So you're telling me it would be the entity that would ask you to look at the project, not somebody else?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and we would ask them to pay us. So
okay.
They're not always willing to pay for an audit.
It's now, that, that answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate your attention to that, and I appreciate your sharing your knowledge on this, and it probably took a bit longer than I anticipated on going over this, but I appreciate your background on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. I think I will move on to the next panel, and we will be talking about the Oregon Home Ownership Stabilization Program update.
Thanks.
Yeah, one of those dirty cups of
people. Flurry of activity here.
Thanks for joining us, man. I'm glad to be here.
So, committee and members of the public were talking about the Oregon Home Ownership Stabilization Program and some federal dollars that will be coming to the state of Oregon, hopefully. And with us, we have Rick Krieger and Lou Savage to give us a little bit of background on this program and the process we're going through at this point.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Lou Savage. I'm Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm really the setup guy for Rick. He's the guy who's been pulling the heavy oar, as well as his agency, Oregon Housing and Community Services. Oregon Housing and Community Services received information on March 29 that the U.S. Treasury had allocated $88 million of TARP money to Oregon. That's the Troubled Asset Relief Program. The purpose of the money is to assist Oregonians who are in danger of foreclosure. This is actually the second round of funding. Oregon's in the second round among five states that have high unemployment rates. That was the reason that the state got allocation. The proposal that Oregon needs to submit is due by the end of this month, so it's a very quick timeline. And the goal is to have a proposal that has some innovative programs and strategies that would prevent foreclosures and stabilize housing markets. The Oregon Housing and Community Services Department has done a great job in quickly pulling together a team to assess the needs of Oregonians. And amongst the tasks that this team has performed is to go out to the community, various communities in Oregon, around the state, and seek input both from community leaders, folks in the financial services community, housing counselors, advocates, and have a public forum for citizens to talk about the problems that they're experiencing and the best way to allocate these funds. We met in Medford, Eugene, Salem, Bend, and in Portland, and really got some very good input both from community leaders and members of the public. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rick to give you just a general outline as to where we think we're going to be going and the kind of the circumstances and the processes that we went through.
Thanks, Lou. I appreciate that. For the record, Rick Crager, Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Chair Holvey, thank you so much for the invitation here today, and also thank you for attending the Eugene Forum. I know that you were in both the meetings that we held down there in Eugene. I've passed out for all of you, it's a PowerPoint presentation that we've actually introduced to the Subcommittee on Human Services yesterday at the Emergency Board, and then was subsequently approved this morning in the full Emergency Board. I'm not going to go through all the details of this because I know you're wanting to move things along, but I thought I would point out some of the key pieces of what we're doing. As Lou said, this has been a very short timeline. We received notification on the 29th. We got guidelines from the U.S. Treasury on the 15th, and they basically said you got 7 weeks to pull together a proposal and give us ideas about how you'd use $88 million across the state. I'm going to start on page 5 and just referring to this to give you a little idea of kind of the approach that we have taken in establishing a program. First and foremost, the goal that we established for the Oregon Homeowner Stabilization Program was to help low and moderately low incomes avoid foreclosure and to help keep a housing cost affordable. And let me just underline avoiding foreclosure, because I think there's sometimes some misconceptions about these dollars, is that, you know, the dollars is essentially given to us to make sure everybody stays in their home. And certainly that is a goal that we have, is that we want to be able to use these monies to more effectively use the current home modification programs administered through the U.S. Treasury. We want to do whatever we can to ensure that they do stay in their home. But I think we also know that unemployment is very high across the state, and it's going to be dependent on people that are unemployed actually having a job to be able to continue to maintain their mortgage. So to the extent that we can do things that help those that can't make it to more effectively transition to an alternative housing and have a, as we say, a graceful exit from their home ownership and be able to provide affordable housing long term, and most importantly, prevent that foreclosure so that at some point down the road we've saved their credit and they can maybe at some point come back and actually own a home later on. So that's one of the key pieces in terms of our approach with this program. In terms of our prioritization, the reason we got this dollar is primarily because of unemployment. As Lou said, we were one of five states that received, and U.S. Treasury targeted us primarily because we had high unemployment rates in 16 counties throughout the state. And there is a graph, I believe, back on page 2, if you wanted to look and see which counties were actually identified. They were all those counties that are listed that are 12% or more in unemployment. And again, one of the things that the Treasury says is that they would like us to make sure that we target those areas that are suffering from unemployment, but they're leaving it to the state to outline what we consider most highly economically distressed, and I'll touch on that here shortly. So again, we're really focusing on the unemployed or those that have been underemployed. The third bullet there talks about leveraging. To make these programs effective, we're going to have to actually work with these financial institutions and work in partnership to try to find ways to leverage these dollars to the extent possible, because $88 million, I know that's, initially a huge amount, but when you look at the problem we have here in this state, to be honest with you, it's a very small fraction of addressing the entire problem. So we're going to need to make these dollars go as far as possible. We're going to be very, very dependent on working with the financial institutions and leveraging it. So as Lou said, we put together a team as quickly as we could to really focus on three of the key pieces of this proposal. I'll touch on two. I won't get too much into the program administration, but I'll touch on the data allocation and the program design. And referring to page seven of the handout, one of the things that's outlined in the guidelines is it says that a substantial majority of the funds will go to the hardest hit counties. And again, like I said, there were 16 that were identified. But as we went across the state, I think one of the things that we learned really quickly is that unemployment certainly is is a key issue, but there's also other things that we need to be considering as well. Foreclosures and delinquencies is a variable that needs to be looked at closely. I think really looking at the change in unemployment in the last 2 years, some of the counties identified there, while certainly have high unemployment, those are unemployment rates that have been that way for many, many years. So we're really looking at what has been the massive change that we've seen in the last couple years. So that was another variable we felt was important. The third, and no more true in Central Oregon when we were there, a lot of concern about really looking at the loss of value in housing. And Lou mentioned that there were five other states that were in a first wave of allocation from the hardest hit funds that got it back in February. The focus on those particular states were the loss in housing values. Again, we're unemployment, but those first five states were really looking at strategies for loss in value. So what we did is we felt like we needed to look at all these variables, go through some statistical analysis to really determine where is truly the hardest hit. So we took these four areas, and you'll see on page 8, and that's a lot of data, and I'm not going to go through all of that specifically, but you can get an idea of when we went through and weighted all those variables, we came up with what was called a housing distress index to determine, okay, which of these counties are above what the state average would be of these four variables. And you'll see that we came up with, actually it was funny enough, 16 counties fell above the state average. 12 of the 16 that were initially identified by the U.S. Treasury were in that mix, and then there were four new ones that was added to the list. So our strategy was we should recognize what the U.S. Treasury put forward as hardest hit, but we also need to recognize those other four areas, that four counties that came up. And those counties happen to be Clackamas, Multnomah, Yamhill, and Marion County. And on page 9, you'll see a map that shows you the areas that we would be targeting the substantial majority. So what we're saying is 80% of the funding would go to these areas, and then the remaining 20% would go to balance of state, which are the white areas. Also, just as a note to you in terms of that map, you'll see that, the ones with the little lines in them are the four new counties that we identified, and then the four that don't have the lines in them, those were the four that fell below the state average, but we would still include, again, because the U.S. Treasury identified those as hardest hits. So that's our proposal as it relates to the allocation. The next piece I'll touch on just briefly is the program piece. And just referring to page 10, and Lou mentioned it, some of the common themes that we heard around the state as we visited, particularly the homeowners, that's where we learned a whole lot. People need more time. If we had some time, if there was any way to design a program that would give us a chance to at least stay current on our mortgage so that potentially we could find a job or maybe get into a different trade. So those were what was one key message we heard. The other one that was, again, very consistent is the current HAMP program, which is the federal program administered through the U.S. Treasury that many of the financial institutions have been using. To be quite frank, they said it's a horrible process in trying to really get through and working with financial institutions, finding a person actually to work with. It's very difficult. And so that was, again, very common across the state. What we heard, again, a lot in the Bend area was how the housing values have declined so much and that many people are simply just ready to walk away. They've maybe lost their job or they're underemployed, and at this point it just doesn't, you know, the best solution to them seems to be just to walk away. And then one other area that I would touch on is that a lot of people were looking for help as it relates to transition. So to the extent that they're not able to maintain their home or keep their current mortgage, who can they turn to? What programs can they turn to effectively help them transition? So in terms of our program, page 11 talks about just kind of generally we would be focusing on families and individuals at 20% of state median income and below that are either unemployed or who have become underemployed due to current economy. And our programs would focus in two areas. First would be really targeting people that are already currently in the system. As I mentioned, a lot of frustration from a lot of individuals about dealing with the current program. In our discussions with lenders and counselors, we've discovered that there are many people out there that would actually qualify if we were able to put a little bit of money into the transaction to actually get to that modification. So one area that we want to focus on is on the pipeline, the individuals and families that are already in the system. The other piece is a more of a comprehensive triage approach, and this would be really focusing on those that are unemployed, they're just coming into the system or underemployed, and really working with them comprehensively to find out what is the best route for them? Where can they go? And if you look on page 12, I love pictures, so it's always easier for me to kind of talk from a picture, but this gives you an idea of how we see the money flowing. You'll see on the left-hand side, $26 million is what we're targeting to go into this pipeline, as I mentioned. We think that this will help about 2,600 households in actually putting money into the transaction and getting them effectively and permanently modified through the HAMP program. Now, one thing that we have been very clear with in dealing with the financial institutions is if we invest in this, we want it to be long-term successful. We don't want to invest in something and find out 4 months later it's defaulted. So we're looking at putting some more criteria in relation to our investment into the transaction. Many times that to qualify, they're just looking, do you have enough money to actually pay for your house? There's not a lot of looking at the back-end ratios and looking at consumer debt and other debt that a household might have. And we're going to put some additional strings on there to ensure that the household that's investing can be successful long term. We see the investment to be about $10,000 or less per household that we'd be able to make these transactions work. Moving to the right side, a little bit more comprehensive, that's $55 million that we would intend on investing in to help individuals, again, that are just entering the system. Consistent message across the state and actually hearing from lenders is that one of the key pieces to really help people are foreclosure counselors, that there needs to be some individual to help them navigate the system, to really look at their existing situation and determine what is the best route, to maybe help them with some of the other financial issues that they might have so that they can be successful. So we feel that we need to invest in that because right now if you look at, and many of you that may have or are familiar with your regional housing centers in your districts, they're already way overworked and not a lot of capacity. So we're going to need to invest in that particular system to be able to respond to the need. The piece to the right, you'll see the four little programs. These would be the toolbox, as I say, is what they would be able to use to try to help someone that's coming through the system. So as an example, if someone's coming in, they're unemployed, perhaps they need some time to, you know, maybe there's a good chance that jobs would be coming back or their particular job would be coming back. Maybe they just need some short-term mortgage assistance, some time. Typically we see is, you know, individuals be on unemployment 4 to 6 months and then they're able to get their job back and be able to continue the mortgage as it was. So that's one scenario. There's another scenario where people may come into the system and they may be unemployed and the realistically getting a job in their community, it just may not happen for them. And a better exit plan for them would be investing in transitional assistance. And you can see we got $4 million plugged into really helping them moving on to alternative housing and being able to preserve their credit so at some point maybe they could come back again and own a home later on. The other situation is you may work with someone, they're unemployed, and maybe they get a job, but perhaps that job isn't what wasn't the salaries they were making before. And you're obviously going to have to modify their loan to the level of income that they're making now. And that's the loan preservation assistance piece where we put about $20 million into that. And that would be a real comprehensive strategy in working with the bank to try to restructure the loan. Maybe it's going through the HAMP modification program. Maybe it's going through some other type of assistance to be able to get their loan modified. And then the last piece I'll point out is the loan refinancing assistance. And we really see this to be a targeted program, really aimed at, right now we're thinking Deschutes County and Jackson County. If you look at the data, you will see the biggest housing decreases values that we've seen are in those two counties. I mean, they're just huge. I believe, I just can't remember, I think Deschutes was like 35%, 40% in terms of the loss in housing values. We think there might be an opportunity to work with households to maybe go and negotiate with lenders to buy these loans at deep discounts and be able to actually take ownership of the note and then hopefully refinance that into a long-term stable situation for the household. We hope to be able to recycle that. And again, this is a, you know, we're asked to be innovative here to try to look at and seek new ways. So this is something a little bit different. There's a lot of state counties right now and states that are looking at this particular proposal and thinking this might be a way to actually effectively work with families. The reason that I say these two areas is because if you look at the loan preservation assistance at $20,000 a household, and that's what we put in terms of a cap, you're not going to really help a family in Deschutes County or in Jackson County where values could be $100,000 underwater. You're really going to have to try to negotiate with the investor to see if there's an opportunity to maybe refinance that loan. Long term. So that's just a quickly, Mr. Chairman, a overview of the programs, just to give you an idea of what we anticipate as outcomes. If you look in page 15, we're planning on serving about 6,200 households with this money. You can see sort of the breakdowns that we expect. About 1,000 households we would think just need short-term assistance to help them buy some time and then hopefully be able to maintain their mortgage as it is. 3,600 households would look at being able to modify a loan or restructure a loan. The 330 households are the innovative program that I mentioned to you where we might be able to revolve some of these and actually buy out the notes at deep discounts. And then finally, 1,300 households would be provided with transitional assistance. In terms of just our next step, and that's to the last page, staff are back at the office right now working frantically to try to get our proposal all done and submitted to the U.S. Treasury on Tuesday. As I said, the emergency board did final approval of our report this morning, and we're hoping that by mid-July we will get some answers back from the U.S. Treasury if they accept our proposal or not. We're going to get this money. I mean, there's no, it's not an application. The money will come to the state. The question is, and the key for the U.S. Treasury is, does our programs meet the intent of TARP money? And that's what they have to really look at and make sure that it's eligible uses. We think that the program would be up and running hopefully earliest, I would say August. More realistically, I would say no later than November is when we would anticipate dollars coming through the door. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my real quick summary. I'm sorry, I probably went through that a little quicker. There's some other components, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you or the committee might have.
I really appreciate you going through that. I think you did a great job, and the amount of time I thought was just about perfect. I do have a couple of questions. And one of the things I heard was the importance of having, you know, some counselors or some sort of assistance to help people through this process, and I'm assuming that some of this money will employ some of those counselors to accomplish that part of the program, and it's probably absolutely essential. And so it's sort of a two-part question. Where do you get the people? Who's hiring them? Right. Or are they coming to you by contract? I know there's probably a lot of realtors out there that are probably qualified to help in this arena. But just logistically, how are you going to get those people on board? Who are they going to work for? And what kind of expertise do they need to have? And at some point, is there somebody with a legal look at this to make sure that people are aware that they, or at least a disclaimer that if they need an attorney, they should consult one, but usually somebody in this situation doesn't have the money for an attorney. So how is all of that going to be handled?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question, and you're absolutely right. I think the thing that we heard is that the counseling is just, you absolutely have to have that as assistance to the individuals that are coming through the system. What we're planning on doing is that we have a great network of regional housing centers that covers 35 counties out of 36. Our only county that we don't don't have quite covered is Harney, so we'll still have to figure that one out in terms of how we provide service. So we have regional housing centers located throughout the state. As I mentioned, though, they obviously right now are over their heads in terms of the calls that they're getting from current caseloads. We're certainly going to have the dollars that go in this will help them to employ actual counselors. We have a great national organization called NeighborWorks that comes out and provides comprehensive training to our foreclosure counselors. We're looking at that as a training mechanism in which we can get a large group of counselors put together, trained appropriately, and get them staffed in each of the regional housing centers. I would say also we've got great staff across the state that have a lot of experience in working with individuals, so we're going to really rely on them a lot to try to go out and provide the training that's necessary to those that need it. I think, you know, if you talk to a lot of the foreclosure counselors, I think that there are a lot of people out there that can do the job. I think it's going to be imperative that we get the right people, and there's a lot of people that were formerly employed at banks that are looking for opportunities. I think you mentioned realtors. I think there's an assortment of individuals and experiences that we see in this area, but we feel pretty confident that our network will be able to deliver.
And Mr. Chair, connected to that, Treasury has told us that although we can provide funding for counselors, it has to be connected to the actual service to the individual. So we're not in a position to provide grants as such. So it will be connected to the triage that Rick had talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. And I have one final question is, and how's the reception been from the lending community and trying to be able to work with you to try to accomplish these goals?
Well, Mr. Chairman, our first forum, I think 2 days after we had the guidelines, is I had this grand notion that we were going to get all the lenders' communities together, and we all going to come together and try to figure out and strategize how to work together. Unfortunately, I think we had two lenders that showed up at our forum. I think since that time, though, we have done a lot of real aggressive outreach to our lending community. I think we've seen a lot of participation. Our local, our Oregon banks have participated. The one bank that has been very open with us has been Bank of America. They've been very forthcoming in trying to come up with programs that we can work with. Right now, our data shows that they own about 50% or service about 50% of the Oregon portfolio. So they are obviously a player and someone that we're going to want to try to work with. They have given us a lot of good ideas in terms of particularly around mortgage assistance, extended forbearance plans. I tell you the one challenging thing that we'll have here is the there's investors behind these loans, the Fannie Mae's, the Freddie Mac's, and really sometimes you get to the bank, but they're really the servicers, and it becomes an investor decision. We're not getting a lot of feedback in terms of principal forgiveness, which is going to be real critical and being able to modify some of these loans and making these programs work. So we're going to continue to push on that, and that's why we put that innovative approach in there, that if we're not able to get this, at least we can go to the banks with a proposal to say, hey, why don't we just take you out and be able to take this loan and work with the individuals in a more strategic way and get the, because we're going to obviously be more interested in maintaining that household for the long term, whereas banks obviously are looking at it from maybe a different perspective. So I would say it's been fair. In terms of the reception, I think that there's a lot of banks that are interested in working with us. Some we haven't gotten as much feedback. Oregon Bankers Association has been really great, though, in terms of trying to help us with that outreach.
So I just have to do one follow-up, I'm sorry, on that. So you're saying of the, when you get into these, the investors, the Freddie Macs and yeah, all that who own the banks, you're not getting a lot of response from them, and seems like they'd be the ones that were more in line with this federal program. But so you're sort of suggesting that we would be using this TARP money to basically buy out those investors and take the position of being the mortgagor in that
particular case?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is a possibility. I think that certainly when you look at that particular strategy, the money doesn't go as far because you're talking about $150,000, $200,000 a shot. So that's why we tried to focus that program more where you're going to have the really huge losses in housing values. Now, if we see down the road that our strategy to actually modify with principal pay downs, other particular strategy using the modification funds, if they're not effective, U.S. Treasury has indicated they'll be very flexible with the states in terms of moving these allocations around. So if one strategy isn't working, we can flip it over to another. I think that, again, we still have to see if this is going to work in terms of the refi the program, but it's certainly something we're looking at closely.
Thank you.
We also have heard from some folks in the Bend area that if the program that Rick described got started and the state was able to help jumpstart this, that there may be some private investors who would also come in and do the same thing, basically buy it out from the bank and then have the kind of program that we were talking about.
Yeah. Seems like, though, as he mentioned, the money wouldn't go very far if you were buying out that position all the way along the road. But other questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how are you going to differentiate between people who, say, have a $1 million home, and if they've lost 40%, then they owe, they're living now in a $600,000 home, and there are other people who maybe have a $200,000 home. If they've lost 40%, now it's worth, help me here, $160,000, right. So if you're looking at high-end homes, then obviously this money is not going to go very far. If you were looking at lower-end homes, you're going to be helping a lot more families. Sure. So how will you differentiate there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, good question. Couple responses. First of all, the U.S. Treasury has put a cap in terms of the loan values that you have. That's not mentioned in your material, but in terms of the guidelines, they have a cap of approximately $730,000. That's approximate. I think it's $729 something. But so there is a cap on how far you can go. The other thing that we have done within our proposal, we've put income limits on this, that there would be 120% state median income or below. So certainly to the extent that if there's families that own $730,000 home and 120%, more than likely any program that we provide isn't going to help them, or we're not going to be able to put enough dollars into it. Please note, on all these programs we put caps, so there's only so far that each of those can go so that we can serve as many families and households as possible. So and then the other piece to this is that, I mean, these are going to have to be individuals that meet the qualification of unemployed. I mean, they're going to have had lost their job, or they're going to have to be individuals that maybe had lost the job and got into a new situation, and the salaries that they had before aren't the same. So we're going to monitor that closely. It's not our intent to do up to the $729,000, but we certainly want to be honoring people that have lost unemployment.
There's a huge difference between people who are in a $700,000 house and who are maybe unemployed, mm-hmm. because they obviously had a high income before they were unemployed,
right.
and difference between somebody who's in a $200,000 house that's mm-hmm. now worth $150,000. They were never obviously making a huge income. So I hope that that will be recognized and dealt with. I'm certainly more interested in helping people who are always low income rather than somebody who was high income and was depending on that to pay for a very expensive house.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, I appreciate that, and certainly within our program guidelines as we start to roll this out, that was something that has been mentioned to us in all the communities, and we'll be very mindful of making sure that we put criteria in there to protect.
That's an interesting point, Representative Tomei. I'm still thinking about it. I tend to agree with you, but at the same time, if somebody's broke and they're in foreclosure, they're broke and they're poor, you know, whether they came from a rich background or a poor one.
I mean, just philosophically.
But there's some potential of them in the future making more money again. Probably somebody with a $150,000 house will never have the potential of buying a house again.
That could be true. Their potential might be different. So, interesting. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to move from class war to geographic war. I really applaud your work in getting around the state and
what war was I on?
I don't know. I think a class war between you two would be interesting.
Close in fighting.
So I really applaud you getting around the state and meeting with folks from around the state. I want to ask a question about how granularly you are or are planning to look in terms of identifying hardest hit communities and locations for, you know, support. If we look countywide, as I look on this map, you know, Multnomah County is, you know, gets a shade, you know, is recognized, but is sort of in the middle of the pack maybe. If you go more granularly I can speak legislative district because I have that data. I think mine was third ranked in terms of highest subprime mortgages. Similarly, with foreclosures, I think although our housing values never got a lot higher, so you didn't have like $600,000 homes going out at 350, right? You had, you know, less than that. If you go a little more granularly, have somebody like Representative Matthews, whose western half of his district would almost certainly be in the top 10, you know, of 100, if you divide the state in 120, and so would, you know, a portion of Representative Hoyle's district. So how, you know, how narrowly are we going to look? How are we going to, you know, look at pockets in areas as you do that spread of the resources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, as we start to roll this out, I mean, we're going to be very dependent on working with, with our regional housing centers. They cover particular counties. So we have, like I said, all regional housing counters cover every county except for one. And so we're going to be very dependent on really trying to identify within that particular county where is the best portion, where should that be distributed, and what are the best particular strategy within the program limits. So we're really going to be looking and working with the local communities and really identifying those pockets or those areas that need to put it out to be able to sub-allocate it. I think one of the pieces that obviously continues to come up is that, okay, you know, who gets this much, how much goes to this county, how much goes to the other county, and certainly we want to be able to spread the dollars out in either the counties based on the absolute needs on the four variables that we talked about. We intend on that being a very open, transparent process in which we again look at all these variables and see, you know, what is the appropriate amount in each of those areas. Now, I think that, as was said at the emergency board yesterday, $88 million, again, a lot of money, but when you look at this as a multi-billion-dollar problem across the state, it is probably about an eighth of it. So.
Final follow-up?
Yeah,
I just want to put a plug in for as we look at counties, you know, particularly our big counties, and I think, you know, in terms of population, not merely geography, you know, put a plug in for East 82nd in Multnomah County, comprises pieces of six different legislative districts, the vast bulk of three to four, and in the interest of full disclosure, all of mine. So right. I'm done then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, when we were in Multnomah County, and this discussion did come up in the several meetings that we had in between our forums, and certainly I think we gave them the same message. We really want to work with you as a community to try to figure out where is the best places to put this. I think Multnomah County presents its own challenges in terms of really trying to find the right individuals and community leaders to work with to make those decisions, but we feel pretty confident that we'll get there.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, a comment to make, and more questions.
Okay.
Gentlemen, you said the e-board approved. What did they approve, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, we were asked to come to the emergency board to provide a report. So they approved it, they acknowledged receipt of the report,
okay,
which
fine.
Was our plan.
Okay, acknowledgement. Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, you, each member of the committee and our two witnesses have provided a copy of a letter from Representative Stegler and myself concerning this subject. We together represent 99% of Deschutes County. as you've been, your testimony is correctly identified. Central Oregon was the main area that was hit and just and resulted in us receiving this money, that the basis of that unemployment numbers and everything, it's was a large part of that. And we appreciate this money coming in. If I was king for the day, I would say that this money should go to jobs, that those people could then pay for their mortgages and things. But we have it, we're going to take it, and we need it in Central Oregon. But saying that, we are concerned, Representative Stiegler and myself and Central Oregon, about the allocation criteria you've described today. So what I'm hearing you say is we still have a chance to discuss that allocation process with you. No disrespect to my good colleague from Portland and his 82nd Avenue and street up there, but the numbers are just there. Your report testifies where Deschutes County's one, Crook County's two, Jefferson's four. So based upon that and the letter you've received, that's the basic summary of the letter, Mr. Chair. My next question is why would, and so I guess this is not locked in, we have a chance to still argue or convince you, why did you go from 16 to 20 counties? I don't understand, because we're talking about $88 million, as you've stated, when you start dividing that up, it should go to the need. Need should be the basis for where we, and also chances of success. And I would question why we went from 16 to 20. Also, Mr. Chair, I asked the witnesses to testify, $7 million admin charge, but you said you're going to turn it over to a nonprofit to run this. How much are they going to charge? How much money are we going to lose there? Let's think, again, not $88 million does used to sound like a lot of money. It still does to me in my household budget, but and my retirement plan and my portfolio and all that stuff. But to address this issue in Oregon, it's not a lot of money, and the more we try to spread it out, I think the less success we're going to have. Is that 7 minutes, Mr. Chair?
Still got a few left.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett. First of all, let me say in terms of the allocation strategy, when we went around the state, one of the things that we wanted to do was talk about exactly what is the best way in terms of distributing this. Now, when we put this plan in, the idea is that they don't want us to get into the details of how much goes to this particular community, how much goes to this community. They want an idea of what is substantial majority and what are sort of that the target region, if you will, that you put it in. We threw out a few things at these forums, things, you know, a lot of the states are taking averages of what the unemployment is in all the counties and then saying, in this case, it was average, basically, that 33% of the population, which is what these 16 counties represented, would get 39% based on what the unemployment. And that was one of the things that we, again, just threw out there for discussion. Another idea that we threw out for discussion as well, because there's need across the state, do you maybe split the pot and say 50% go to one, you know, the 16 counties, the other 15 go to the balance of state? Again, just sort of the discussion. One of the things that we learned, and I think to your point, and I agree with you 100%, is that you have to really determine hardest hit by what is the need, what are the biggest factors there, and that's why we came back after all these meetings and really got into the data and said, you know, what did we hear? And here was some of the things that were really loud and clear. Number one, you really need to look at the change in unemployment. You can't just say unemployment. You got to look at what is the change been in the last 2 years. You also have to look at housing values. How bad have they dropped? I mean, that's another thing that, again, very loud and clear. And you have to be really mindful of foreclosure and delinquencies. The other message was it shouldn't be a population thing. It should be based on those type of factors. So that's exactly what we did, is we came back and we took the data. We had all the best information, and that's what all that stuff, that data leads to. And what we found is we found the state average, and then we said what counties are above that average and what counties are below. Again, like I said, there were four counties that were of the 16 that actually fell below what that economic stress was, and there were four counties that come above. And so to honor the initial process, the 16, we said, well, we should at least honor what the U.S. Treasury put in and then add the additional four. These are all based on, at least from our perspective, what has been deemed as hardest hit based on data. So I would say, Representative Wisnett, we listened and we have changed the allocation strategy that we had presented across the state when we traveled. The other piece that I think you brought up was the whole issue of nonprofit. And that's not something I touched on here today, Mr. Chairman, but I'm happy to. I thought your focus was more on the program stuff. But part of this money, this TARP dollars, there's a requirement that a financial institution receive it. State government cannot receive this money directly. So for us to be the state to even get the dollars, we as a state housing finance agency have to establish a nonprofit entity that qualifies so that the money can be received. Essentially, that entity is going to be a repository for the funds. Then there will be a contract between that entity and ourselves to actually administer the programs. The two keys to this is, number one, the U.S. Treasury said this has to be a financial institution. Number two, they want the Housing Finance Agency to be the oversight entity for it. So it's sort of a way to qualify to receive the TARP funds and then put it into the hands of the Housing Finance Agency administrator. So that $7 million that you referred to, Representative Wisnett, that is specifically to provide the oversight. There's going to need to be a lot of outreach to make sure people know about these programs and doing a lot of communication. And then, of course, the reporting. I think we found with ARA and the monies that have come through, there's usually a substantial amount of reporting. So that's what that represents.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, you certainly have time left.
Just a statement, and again, I'm not looking to get horse in the mouth here, but the statement from the Treasurer does say the counties with the highest concentration of economic distress will receive a substantial majority of funding. Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Mr. Representative Wisnett. I think your point was shared across the state from the input that they received, and I think they're aiming to accomplish that goal.
As Mr. Chair, I would say that not only Ben but Medford made that argument loud and clear.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. First comment I'd make is, I respect the job you're doing on this, and thanks very much for putting this together quickly. I look forward to hearing about how the banks in the area are going to be involved in this, too, and I think that's great. It's certainly going to take a strong jobs package as well, because it doesn't matter if you pay it off. They have to have the ability to pay it beyond that. I just want to be clear. On page 12, to the right, there's the four criteria over there, the four programs that it says. Now, if you find the need that the loan refinancing assistance doesn't need the $10 million, but it would actually serve better in mortgage payment assistance, you can move that money, correct? So you'll have the ability to do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Matthews, absolutely. And that's the only thing that the Treasury is really concerned about is that they get a contract between us and our entity by October 3rd. After that point, they've said, you know, if you're feeling one strategy is working the better, you're going to have flexibility to move it.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And in respect to picking winners and losers, I understand by percentages. I mean, I wish all this money could go to Gresham. Every legislator would want it to go to their district. We get that. I would argue, though, that the individual with the $700,000 home is also hurting significantly. And they, as far as ability to earn, their ability to earn is going to be significantly impacted to where they're going to be underemployed for a great deal. And I think that's just a tough obstacle. Some would argue perhaps they're even hit harder because they've been living at the level that they've been maintaining. But beyond that, when you talk about the TARP funds, this can go for state and federally chartered banks as well. Is that correct? They can all. And then beyond that, please, if you let me, are there going to be significant hoops to jump through to where they don't want to participate then, to where we're going to have a hard time recruiting those banks and entities? Because I'd sure like to see our local banks get involved and be able to do this in their community.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Matthews, in terms of the state charter versus national banks, certainly all of them are able to participate. I believe the percentage I got from U.S. Treasury is 90% of the banks are actually participating in the HAMP program. So certainly this will be... that is incentive for them to work with us because we can help them in terms of making that program work. There is obviously a small portion out there of banks that don't, but we've left this program open enough that it don't necessarily have to have a HAMP program. If there's another creative strategy to keeping them in the home, we can work with them as well.
Great job. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, one other point to Rick's comment. About 75% of the mortgages in Oregon are held by national banks. So we really do want to get participation from state banks, but the national banks are the big players.
Excellent.
Quick statement from Representative Wingard.
Just a point of clarification on that, Mr. Chair. How many of the home loans in Oregon are owned by the two government agencies, Fannie and Freddie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, I don't have an answer to that. I can certainly look back and I'll follow back with you to see, but I don't have a count on the percentage that are Fannie and Freddie owned.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it needs to be said, not to rain on anybody's parade here, and I know you guys have struggled to put together a proposal for this money that the federal government is offering, but by your own numbers, we're talking about $88 million, 6,200 or so households. That's an average of about $14,125 per. I think the number of people being assisted is a drop in the bucket, clearly, especially as you spread it out around the state. Of course, even if you concentrated it in one area, you'd leave most of the state unassisted. This is all debt spending. Federal government does not have the money for this, and so it's not really $88 million. It's far more than that that will have to be paid back over the decades as it is heaped onto this country's debt load. So it's our children and grandchildren who will be paying for this program, and it will be far more expensive than this. I believe the government already owns or will own most of these loans anyway because the two entities that I just mentioned have a significant share, well over 90%, of the mortgages in this country. There's no ability for this program to assure any long-term success for the people that you are going to renegotiate loans for or simply assist. You can't know what the economy is going to do in the next 12 to 24 months, so you're going to provide assistance to people and perhaps a renegotiation, and they may very well still be unable to hold on to their home 6 months or 12 months later, but we will have spent the money that was debt money, pass it on to our children, and have no ability to assure any success. The fundamental reality is that some people were homeowners who could not afford to be homeowners. That and the fact that a lot of people are hurting, I understand that, but I'm just not convinced this program ultimately, for what we're doing as far as the debt spending, really can make a legitimate argument that it's going to help enough people. It's very, very expensive, and I think it's a drop in the bucket, and the outcomes are extremely vague, 12, 24, 36 months out.
And thank you for the commentary there, Representative Wingard, and for another one, Representative Call.
Oh, I'll be brief. I just want to say if you guys want to redo this and apportion it via legislative districts, my district will take Representative Wingard's share.
That's how we got here, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate the work you're putting into this, and hopefully this program will help some people. So, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, I'd like to move on to next thing on our agenda, I believe, is a recap of the implementation of a couple of bills that have passed out of this committee, House Bill 2189 and House Bill 2191. And David Tapman will be coming up. And Keith Dubanovich at some point, anytime you'd like. And And so the purpose of
taking a look at these two bills is basically to see what has happened with the implementation of these two bills, see if there's a report back from the agencies to see if there's some glitches or something that this committee should be aware of or anything that we may need to address or not. So welcome, Mr. Tapman.
Mr. Chair, always a pleasure to be here in front of you and your committee. My name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And your introduction did us well. As you've said, these are two bills that were passed out of the last general session, and they were initiated in this committee. Without assuming too much, I know you have a number of new committee members, so I don't want to plow over already pre-plowed ground, but I do want to make sure that there is enough understanding about what this does so that questions can be asked and hopefully answered. What I'll do is I'll start with House Bill 2189. 2189 focused on mortgage lending in the state of Oregon, and it was generated at the state level in response to actions by Congress in 2008. Congress at that time adopted the Safe and Fair Enforcement Mortgage Lending Act in reaction to some of the things we've heard about from Representative Wingert and others today, a concern about how mortgage lending had fallen on hard times, people were not being able to hold on to their loans, houses were in disarray, and frankly, the financial systems were not working well. There was a lot of concern about the quality of many of the mortgages that were made and certainly about the qualifications of some of the people that were receiving those mortgages as well as the disclosures and information needed to make informed decisions. Congress implemented this act and instructed all states to adopt something comparable called the SAFE Act, and we did that in 2009. The purpose of this was twofold. One, to ensure that all mortgage loan originators, the individuals who work with consumers directly, one-on-one people, had certain minimum qualifications, and so the law requires that they take certain education courses, pass the courses, they take certain examinations on state and federal mortgage-related laws, that they have passed a criminal background check, and that they have certain credit worthiness determined. All those factors exist in the Oregon law, and in fact have been we've begun to implement that. The other piece of this was to develop a national database, because as we've seen time and again, the states are no longer separate entities so much as they're just part of a large United States, and people move frequently. And so we feel like if someone was a problem in one state without a national database, they could go off and do the same thing somewhere else. So this database will have all those that are registered as loan originators as well as mortgage lending companies have to be filed within that database, given a unique identifier number, information is provided about them, including fingerprint checks and alike, and subsequent enforcement actions in the near future will be recorded in that database. This will allow consumers to access that database as well as contact their state regulator if need be to get information about these individuals providing those services. So that, by way of background, is what the bill was intended to do. Because this is a large industry, that took a fair amount of time to implement. The law went into effect last year, but the licensing requirements began in 2010. In the interim period of time, we've had several rulemaking procedures to address the issue. I'd like to think that we've done a good job around consumer protection in conjunction with those rulemaking issues. We use these as an opportunity to clarify who will be qualified, what kind of back criminal history will be reviewed, what will be permitted to pass through, and what will be a barrier. We also have increased standards for advertising, make sure that advertisings are not false and deceptive. We also have now mandated, as you've seen in other areas, and we'll talk a little bit more later on in the debt management area, a requirement that if you advertise, and advertising includes media, that is newspapers, radio, television, and the internet, you have to identify yourself by a unique identifying number indicating that you're licensed to do so in the state of Oregon. And then finally, we've addressed the issue of people who hold themselves out with special designations. We've seen a lot of complaints about that, particularly in the area of senior citizens, where people will represent themselves to be senior specialists. and people will be invited to attend seminars by these senior specialists, and they have no greater experience or expertise than any one of us standing here. However, they did pay for a diploma or a document that says they're now a senior specialist. So we've made sure that they can't take and use those designations unless they are provided by what, for shorthand, I'll call a legitimate accreditation organization. And those are our administrative rules, and so far we've met with good success with that. In January, we started licensing the mortgage lenders, the mortgage banker brokers. Those are the companies that employ the mortgage loan officers. And most of them were the ones who, when times were flush, were the ones providing the brokerage of loans to the national banks, to Countrywide, to those big companies that then would fund those. And then were sent on into the stream of commerce with investors and credit mortgage obligations and alike. So those companies are now in our system, and we were concerned that there might be, because of the difficulty in the economy, that we might see a downturn in that. But in fact, as of December, before the new law kicked in, we had 830 mortgage brokers, and as of May 1, we have, and this is in my testimony, actually it isn't in my testimony, we have 725. So we're seeing that the number's holding firm, which is important for us because that's how we're able to conduct our enforcement activity. Without that funding, we are hard-pressed to engage in the enforcement activity, which is so critical right now. In April of this year, we started licensing of loan originators, as I said, the individuals who were actually work one-on-one with consumers. We've gotten 500 people licensed already. We've got another 200 pending, and we've received applications from 1,400. The good news is that we have committed to making sure that on August 1st, the deadline date in the bill, that they will be licensed. So all these people will have no break in service and the opportunity to continue to work with people. The bad news is we anticipate there may be another up to 2,000 people who, for whatever reason, have chosen at this point not to indicate, send an application in, that they intend to get licensed. So right now we've got about half of what we anticipated in our system. I'm hoping that we'll see a whole lot more. We've indicated through mailings, we do a quarterly newsletter, we send out emails to all licensees, we've got indications on our website that people recognize that time is of the essence, particularly if you have to take an examination and go through a fingerprint process and a background check and so forth and so on. We have a drop-dead date of May 31st to ensure that we can get everyone licensed by August 1st. If they aren't licensed by then, they will have to bear the consequences of the processing. So we hope that we get a last-minute rush, if you will. We do have one issue left. I think it's worth noting, and that is around the area of nonprofits and government agencies in what is known as self-help home organization programs or SHOP programs. And when you hear SHOP, just think of something like Habitat for Humanity. All these organizations historically were not subject to any licensing in the state of Oregon under our old licensing regime. But under Congress's definition of loan originators, which has been broadly and tightly written, these entities, or at least the individuals representing these entities, could fall within that definition. That is somewhat problematic because these are companies or entities that don't have a lot of money to spend on the licensing process. On the other hand, as others have pointed out, it's important that those people with less means who will probably be going through nonprofits and government agencies for some assistance or some help in the mortgage process deserve to have people that are equally qualified. So we're trying to balance that process out right now. What looms over all that is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, who's been charged by Congress to implement rules, to implement the SAFE Act. They're the gatekeeper, and at this point they have yet to weigh, they've done some preliminary rulemaking, but they have not come down with a final decision on the rulemaking, which of these nonprofits, the Habitats for Humanity, county agencies and alike, will be in and which will be out. So at this point we're developing an interim strategy because the law goes into effect August 1st, and we're trying to figure out how to balance that while waiting for HUD. So if you will, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is probably the glitch we're struggling with the most right now. And And with that, I'll conclude on 2189, unless there are questions or points that you'd like me to further follow up on.
Well, I appreciate that report, and it was fairly concise. Just the glitch you're speaking of, though, of the nonprofits, and seems to be at hopefully being resolved at the federal level. And I would assume that when that happens, that your department, the state, would come in line with that definition.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be our goal. At this point, for instance, we think something like Habitat for Humanity, which doesn't really engage in making mortgages, they're more involved in the creation of these houses and, if you will, selling the house and holding some interest in that. We think those types, the shops, should be outside the purview of this. And so we're hoping that at a minimum HUD gives us enough latitude to do just that. That has been a proposal. We have written a letters during the rulemaking process, as have a number of stakeholder groups, such as the Council of State Bank Supervisors and the like, have written letters to identify these problem areas. We're hoping HUD will do that, and yes, our intention would be stay in compliance with that. If they give us enough latitude, we will then try and do this as we see as most efficient and beneficial to Oregon.
Thank you, and I would assume that our last panel, speaking of the foreclosure counselors, I don't know where they fall in that realm, but anyway, it was an interesting overlap.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point. That's something we're trying to keep out of the fray, is those that are just advising as opposed to actually negotiating should be out of it.
Thank you. Any questions on 2189? Not seeing any, so if we want to move on to House Bill 2191.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll lead off again. For the record, this is David Tapman, and again, I'm still the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Yes, if I didn't say anything too offbeat. And with me is Keith Dabanovich, Special Counsel for the Attorney General's Office. And what we're here to talk about at this point is the implementation of House Bill 2191. Again, it's a bill that was adopted last full session in 2009 that, again, originated right here in this committee. For those that are less initiated in this process, there's a one-page handout that identifies the factors of what is involved in debt management programs. Previously, we had laws that specifically addressed debt consolidation agencies and credit service organizations. But what we found was we had a donut, but we had a huge hole for debt settlement companies. Debt settlement companies are ones you probably hear on television, see on signboards, get email pop-ups, whatever, that talk about helping you reduce or eliminate all credit problems. And so that the purpose of, or really what in general the bill was to address debt settlement companies, and I think we've done a good job of that. There's a one-pager that kind of describes what we do and what has to be done under that, and I'll leave that to you to read that unless somebody wants that for the record. What I'll talk about a little bit is what we've done to implement the bill itself. At the time, we had roughly 65 entities licensed with us under the old law. Law took effect in terms of licensing requirements January 1, and in that time we've licensed 46 entities or registered 46 entities, and we have 10 more pending. So we're not too far from where we were before. Interestingly enough, we haven't seen it. I think we've received one debt settlement an application from a debt settlement company. They have made a decision that they don't like the MO, the modus operandi in Oregon, and so they are not have not gotten licensed to date in Oregon. Yet they are certainly continuing to advertise in Oregon. And so what we find, we spend an inordinate amount of time talking with consumers, addressing consumer concerns about dealing with these debt settlement companies that frankly aren't licensed in Oregon and people shouldn't be doing business with them. So our focus has been on outreach in trying to educate the public and educate industry as well. And you'll see that you've got a colored brochure that we've just put together that talks about how to address situations that pop up for consumers entitled Need Help With Your Debt. And it addresses basic questions that come up. Who is a debt settlement provider? What do they have to do to qualify? What services should they provide? What things shouldn't they be telling you? For instance, if you're advised that you should not be in contact with your creditors and don't respond to your creditors, that's terrible advice and often leads to foreclosures or other actions by the creditor. So the legitimate folks won't be saying things like that. And those that should be in the brochure. In addition, we have more specific frequently asked questions on our website, and it's referenced in that brochure. Our goal is to let the public know there is protection out there, but some of this is incumbent upon the public to instigate that. And what you'll see is there was a brochure that we, or a pamphlet we handed out, and this is a place where we're asking the public to help us help them or help themselves. And that says, Help Stop Illegal Debt Management Companies in Oregon. And what it is it's just a notepad that you could have by your phone or a radio or television, in which if you see an ad and you don't see an Oregon license number, we're asking the public to flag those, identify them, give us as much information as they can, and then send it to us. They can send it to us by internet. It can be done anonymously. We prefer, obviously, to have somebody behind it, but they don't have to. They can mail this in if they want to. They can phone us in. But what we're saying to the public is, help us identify these violators. When we get this information, then we will meet with Mr. Vanovich, or at least somebody within the Department of Justice, to sit down and formulate a strategy to take out those who are the worst violators of the law. We think by doing this, much like the Construction Contractors Board, CCB, has done, if we can educate the advertisers and we can educate the public to look for the license number, people will then stop avoiding these folks who provide services that are grossly in violation of the law and worse, are financially very damaging. In the realm of enforcement, we've gotten, as I said, a number of complaints. We've received 40-plus complaints since January. One example is really quite disturbing. One consumer said that he paid over $10,000 to one of these companies, not licensed with us, a debt settlement company. And in fact, that the company did make some payments, minimal payments, but they weren't getting what they expected from the process and clearly have paid an egregious amount of money above what they should have been paid under state law. We contacted the company. They agreed to cancel the contract, waive all the cancellation fees, and refund unused fees that had been paid by the consumer. So overall, that's an extreme example, but we've done this probably in 16 different cases where we've gotten fees refunded back to the companies. At this point, though, it's going to take more action than that, and I think this is where the enforcement process steps up, and we hope to work closely with the Department of Justice. We had a good example of that recently with a company in my remarks called Credit Solutions of America, where DOJ took the lead and we were able to piggyback on that. And so what I'll do is refer that over to Mr. Dubanovich, and then I'm happy to answer any questions when he gets done.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich, and I am Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. As the committee members will remember, the concern that resulted in 2191 was debt settlement companies that were charging high upfront fees and either disappearing from the state and taking the consumer's money or advising them to not pay the bill, pay their mortgage, and then they would get into worse and worse default, and it wasn't necessarily in the consumer's best interest. So the legislature stepped up and recognized that there needed to be some regulation in this field, and fortunately we've seen so far that things are moving in the right direction. What it requires, as Mr. Tapman indicated, that is debt management companies have to be registered. That's clearly a step in the right direction so that we have some control over who's doing business in the state of Oregon. They cannot charge upfront fees, which is extremely important. They have to be bonded so that if they disappear, we can chase after the bond that they posted to do business in the state. They have to have a written agreement with the consumer, which is extremely important so that the consumer knows what services they are getting or are not getting. And all of those are actually very good pro-consumer things that are actually also good business as well. We, as Mr. Tapman indicated, have initiated and completed a assurance of voluntary compliance with Credit Solutions of America. Credit Solutions of America is one of the nation's largest debt settlement companies. We worked very closely with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities in investigating that matter, and what we found is that they were charging very high upfront fees and encouraging their customers to not pay their mortgage. What exactly they were going to do afterwards was unclear. They did not have appropriate agreements. They were not in compliance with Oregon law. And as a result of the enactment of House Bill 2191, we have gotten an agreement with that company that they will cease to do business in our state for 3 years. They are required to pay restitution to every consumer that they have done business with in the state of Oregon. And if after 3 years they want to come back and do business here, they have to petition the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and establish that they actually can and should be allowed to do business in compliance with Oregon law. We have received approximately 40 consumer complaints about debt settlement companies since the beginning of this year. And we are pursuing two matters presently. One involves a debt settlement company and one involves a debt management company. These are investigations that we're handling along with attorneys general's offices from other states, and they are confidential, so I can't go into any more details than that. We're also working on a couple of other matters with Mr. Tapman's office. I think the working relationship is working as planned and hoped for. And frankly, the law is a tremendous step in the right direction for the benefit of consumers in the state. So I'll conclude my remarks with that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. I have one question just in regards to the advertising piece of this and them having to display their license number. You know, I don't know if there's rules. I would assume there are because you see these ads on TV. In the bottom of the screen for a half a second, you see this. I assume it's a disclaimer, but it's so small I can never really read it and can't really see what it says and whether or not it has a license number at the bottom of the screen or not, and then it's gone. And if I was quick enough to freeze frame it and knew how to do that and then magnify it, you know, I could probably see that. Is there any particular rules around that kind of display of advertising or display of a disclaimer or whatever it happens to be, I guess. Maybe the license number is in there. I just haven't been able to catch it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did adopt rules. I'm looking through them as I speak to you. I am trying to determine. I don't recall, and so I may be wrong, and if so, I'll follow up with that. I don't recall us addressing specifically anything like size of the font or length of time it had to be displayed. My hope is that these companies, and that this hasn't happened yet, but these companies will, if they have concluded they're not to do business in Oregon and they put that quick disclaimer down there and somebody from Oregon calls and it displays a 503 number or somebody gets a mailing from Oregon, they'll say, I can't do business with you. I know that the Department of Justice and others have had some success with out-of-state companies, particularly around the Do Not Call list, who have said, we know we can't do business in Oregon, I have to decline. And so having said that, I'm looking at the rule right now, and it just says material designer made to, let's see, it just says shall disclose. So that may be something we want to take back and address further to make sure that it's useful and not just a checkbox that someone is doing to be in compliance.
And I would assume you could probably do that under the current statute with rule.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. And one other quick question.
question was, you mentioned being able to engage with attorney generals from other states on this, and I guess previously, we without this law in place, we couldn't have done that.
Correct. Chair Halvey?
You're correct. Because there was no regulation and no prohibition about what they could or could not do in the state of Oregon, we would not have been working with other state attorneys general. Not every state has a law like ours, so it's not a completely a national organization that's working in this field. The states that are, though, are working very closely together because many of these companies are indeed national in scope.
Now, and along those same lines, I've encouraged my federal delegation to look into this particular industry, and I know that there have been discussions in Washington, D.C. about regulation of this particular industry. Do you have any... I haven't been following that closely, but do you know if that is moving ahead or not?
Chair Halvey, I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, I don't either. I suspect that that's been something that was tabled while we were getting through the current financial reform issues. But I know there has been a conversation, at least with one senator, about that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, maybe I missed it when you were talking, but... this is a pretty interesting brochure. Have you thought about requiring by rule that debt management companies mail this to every new customer that they sign up? So that, you know, we require banks to send, all of these financial agencies to send their little privacy notices, which I get in the mail, so why couldn't we require them to do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I think that's a great idea. We probably want to talk with the industry about that, but I think that makes a lot of sense. Frankly, we just came up with a brochure, and we probably haven't even developed the full rollout yet, and I think that would be a great part of our rollout.
Other questions? Representative Call.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where final rulemaking authority lies, because if I'm correct, the Attorney General's enforcement power comes from an expansion, making certain conduct unlawful under the UTPA, which would generally be within the Attorney General's purview to create rules under the UTPA against industries, but also DCBS is, I think, the one who promulgated these rules. So is there a dual rulemaking authority there, with whom should we be speaking when we're talking about wanting to make rules?
Chair Halvey, Representative Call, it would be our position that because these are entities that are licensed and therefore regulated by DCBS, the DCBS would be in the lead on any regulations. My recollection is that we would be allowed to pass some regulations with the consent of DCBS, but we don't see a need to. They're in the lead on this, and they should continue to do so.
Mr. Chair and Representative Call, we agree. As a regulator, we take primary responsibility for implementation through rules, and then I think, as you pointed out, the UTPA is more of a broad law enforcement authority that they would address broader issues, not specifics.
So in one final note, I know that the real estate agency is in the room, and I know that there's a little piece of this bill that also deals with loan modification, and so has that really been flushed out of when somebody that does loan modification falls under this particular bill, when they don't?
Well, it sounds like a regulatory matter, Mr. Chair, so I guess I'll take first crack at that. We have spent a fair amount of time discussing that. As you may know, under 2189, we also address the issue of loan modification, and mortgage loan originators could be deemed to be loan modifiers, too, depending on the nature of the loan. So we essentially have two places where people could get licensed to engage in loan modifications, so they're not engaged in illegal conduct. Our position has been that you've got to be one or the other. You either get licensed as a mortgage loan originator, and you heard about the testing and the criminal history background and the bonding and so forth, or you can get licensed as a debt settlement provider, which doesn't have any of that requirement, but has a fairly restrictive fee, as you'll see in that one-page memo I handed out, for how much a person can actually earn through loan modification. So it's kind of a decision by the individual how they want to proceed. Most of the loan modifiers that have attempted, that have come forward to get licensed, have done so as mortgage lenders. We also know that the real estate agency has received a great great deal of correspondence and calls and questions regarding the role of real estate agents in something called short sales. And that's been a hot topic. And in fact, we met collectively, DOJ, our agency, and our real estate agency, recently to discuss just that. A couple weeks ago, we got a draft of frequently asked questions they wanted to address with their real estate brokers. Real estate emphasis, and so I think we're essentially okay with that. I've asked a staff member to try and get back to them ASAP on that this week if possible. But we're still trying to sort all that out, who is in and who isn't. For the most part, we think if you're engaged in loan modification, you have to be licensed in some capacity. Most of those 42 complaints that we've received probably either focus on debt settlement or on loan mods themselves. There are some broad carve-outs, though, for loan modification, as you know. And so we spend a lot of time trying to chase down if somebody is, in fact, a servicer or is, in fact, the person who actually holds a loan, who obviously doesn't have to be licensed to engage in loan modification and things like that. So it's a fairly time-consuming process, and I don't feel like we've achieved the level of clarity we want, but we are moving forward, and I think we're getting there.
Well, thank you. Not that any of you would want this committee's help in addressing that issue, but if it should become necessary, I'm sure we would be happy to help you out with that.
Thank you.
So no other questions. I appreciate that update. It sounds like it's going along well, and appreciate all your efforts in this, because I really think this was a huge area of where consumers have been at risk. Committee, we have one last report, and it comes from Elizabeth Harchenko from the Department of Revenue, giving us an update on perhaps the implementation of the Interagency Compliance Network in a bill that we passed 2009 as well, on the Interagency Compliance Network, House Bill 2815. And welcome. I know these are trying times for your department, but I appreciate you taking the time just to drop by and give us a brief summary on where we're at with the implementation of this.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. The packet that you're receiving has three pieces to it. There's a cover memo, one-page summary of a request that we made to the Emergency Board, which was approved this morning. There's an action plan, and then a copy of the interagency agreement signed by the seven agencies that are participating in the group. Just a quick recap. Seven agencies were directed by House Bill 2815 to work together to look at a broad array of issues around compliance with regulations, regulatory statutes, insurance requirements, and tax compliance in the employment arena. Those agencies are listed on the action plan: the Employment Department, Department of Consumer and Business Services, Department of Revenue, Department of Justice, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Construction Contractors Board, and Landscape Contractors Board. The legislature set aside $750,000 in the emergency fund for the agencies to come forward with an implementation plan, and the plan has four strategies to it. The agencies are going to create a cross-trained group. One of the things that we've heard a number of times from people in industry is that if an agency, say the Department of Revenue, has reviewed compliance with withholding law and has found some concerns, and then we share the information with the Employment Department, then the Employment Department comes in, and then they share the information with the Workers' Compensation Department, and the Workers' Compensation Department comes in, and businesses end up with what they would call serial audits by state agencies looking at probably about 80% the same thing. So we're going to cross-train staff so that a single person can interact with a business, determine compliance with unemployment insurance coverage, workers' comp, withholding, wage and hour, licensing requirements, come in, visit, and make the determination and leave, and not have a sequence of people coming in and reviewing basically the same issues. We have we will measure the effect of using this kind of strategy in a couple of different ways. One would be increased tax and wage assessments and payments, numbers of businesses that we touch over a period of time, comparing to sort of the old way of sharing information and this new coordinated cross-trained focus, licensing and insurance violations discovered, and cost per business contact. We will be able to take advantage of an electronic system that was developed by the Secretary of State's office in collaboration with many of these agencies to verify any licensing requirements and whether they're being complied with. One of the key features of House Bill 2815 allowed the agencies to share information much more freely than we had been in the past in order to achieve compliance with our responsibility areas. And so the Department of Revenue is going to coordinate analysis of data to look for trends, whether it's in industries or particular businesses, and coordinate the matching of information to determine whether there are patterns of behavior that require follow-up, and to determine baseline compliance levels in industry groups. That data sharing should help us improve the effectiveness of the compliance teams. And we also are going to be able to fund some augmented staffing at the Department of Justice. They will be bringing on a financial investigator to look at potential criminal law violations that might be referred by the other participating agencies. We've had one. I know that when the bill was being considered during the session, Department of Justice described a prosecution that they had just concluded where a drywall contractor had been evading unemployment insurance, withholding workers' comp, and a number of other laws by characterizing their employees as independent contractors, and they had achieved a conviction there. So they will be looking for that level of evasion going forward in coordination with the agencies. Also, in being mindful of the effect that the economy is having on the world of work, we want to make sure that we are providing appropriate information and tools for people who might be going into business for themselves or trying to find work in different ways, what the rules are and what they need to do to comply, and what the obligations of businesses are with respect to employees and with respect to independent contractors. Bureau of Labor is going to coordinate that for us. We have a website, but it hasn't been updated for a while, so we will be updating and improving that website and using web-based technology and other tools for sharing the information that people need in order to understand what the requirements are and to comply with them. And as I said, the emergency board did approve disbursement of the funds this morning, so we'll be beginning that process. The agencies are viewing the resources as one-time money, and that our task is to determine the efficacy of these different strategies, report back to the legislature on the return on that investment, and then determine going forward what we can embed into our base operations to greater achieve compliance with the independent contractor statutes going forward. So I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Questions? I guess I have one. You know, dealing with the looming budget issues and revenue issues that we're faced with now that, I mean, this money was set aside last session and is now just now being allocated out. Should there be a cut that cuts across different agencies, I would assume that this program would stay intact, but maybe not at the full amount that it currently is. I hate for you to conjecture on that, but I'm just kind of curious how that would fit into, you know, as we're trying to move this forward, seeing that this looks like,
potentially will be a very effective way for our agencies to operate efficiently and also to return the revenues that are due to the state. This program wouldn't then be on a chopping block, which would make it ineffective.
Mr. Chair, I think that the mechanics of the way the funds are being distributed is they're going to be allocated to the Department of Revenue to manage on behalf of all the agencies. And so we will talk with our partners. The governor's direction, as you know, is for all of us who have general funds to prepare plans over the next 2 weeks of how we would absorb our share of the reduction. And I would be working with the partner agencies to talk about how we could make sure that the work that we need to do in connection with this gets done. We were prepared for the possibility that we might not get the funds, and that at some reduced level we knew that we still needed to try to do some of this work. So I think we're ready to be flexible and nimble and be responsive to the greater financial situation. But before any of this would be, the department wouldn't do a reduction unilaterally. We would be talking to our partners about whether and to what extent any reduction could be absorbed in this particular allocation of resources or not. So in the next 2 weeks, we'll be making those decisions.
Thank you. I appreciate your efforts in trying to get this implemented. And I know it's been a long process, so I appreciate all your efforts and all the agencies that participated in it. Any questions on this agenda item? I'm not seeing any for you. I certainly have a couple of conversations that I'll probably have with you in the next few weeks or next few months, however our times intersect with talking about the future of this program and how it interplays with some other agencies that aren't in here.
Okay. So, well, Mr. Chair, as we move forward with implementation, I'd be happy to report back to the committee the next time you meet. In the fall on how we're doing and what we're seeing as a result of some of the changes that we're able to make.
Thank you. We'll certainly have that conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Committee, that concludes our agenda. Don't know if anyone has anything for the good of the order. Or
have we welcomed Representative Call? Is this his first meeting?
It is.
Oh, well, he came in late, so I didn't have time to do it at the beginning.
Thanks for calling me.
It's the last time it'll happen.
It's quite appropriate to welcome him to this committee at the end. So, Representative Call, good to have you to fill out the dais, I guess, and appreciate your attention to these issues. They're all very important and fascinating, as many of my committee members will tell you, that they are very riveting and engaging discussions that we have in this committee.
And he's appropriately seated to my left.
but usually the other vice chair has a lot more to say.
Yeah. Really? I have a question this summer. Enjoy your family.
I'm Gilliam.
Can we gavel?
Are you
first?
Coming back?
I am, because a lot of the first timers don't come back. So we'll be glad to have you. I'm here, man.
Okay.
I'm here for the long haul.
Okay.
I don't scare easily.
I'm not going to make any comments at that point. So. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.
And you.
Thank you for your attention.
I didn't mean it that way.